Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's conference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Don Leister, DC Director. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, and thank you to everyone who's joined us today for this call. We're at a very momentous point in the immigration reform debate that's happening in Congress, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak with all of you. As you know, the National Immigration Center has been advocating for a broad and inclusive immigration reform package that provides a pathway to citizenship for all of the 11 million aspiring citizens, as well as the rights and responsibilities that go along with citizenship. This week, the Senate has continued to debate S-744, the bill that was reported out of the Senate Judiciary Committee last month. The last time that we spoke on our NILC field call, it was after that committee markup. Now the Senate is into the second week of debate on the bill. Several amendments have been offered and approved, but today, actually, some important procedural measures were taken that line up the Senate to possibly pass a bill by the end of next week. And what happened today was that Senator Reid took some procedural steps to set up a vote on a border security amendment that was designed to attract more Republicans to vote for immigration reform. And the border security amendment would require a large investment in technology infrastructure and personnel along the border before immigrants could switch from RPI status to LPR status. And we are just now getting the text of this language, so what I'm sharing with you now about the amendment is just our understanding of it, but of course NILC is going to be doing a full analysis in the hours to come, and we'll share information with you all as we learn more. But again, this would make a significant increase in border security, including doubling the number of border agents, completing 700 miles of the border fence, and deploying additional technology such as cameras. So basically, now that this amendment has been filed, this amendment is not only addressing border security, but many, many other amendments that have been offered by senators leading up to today. And so Senator Reid has filed for a motion to invoke cloture on Monday, which means to cut off debate on this new border security amendment, which also includes the larger Senate immigration reform bill. So barring any further agreement, the Senate will vote on Monday to cut off debate on this border security amendment. It will then vote on Wednesday to cut off debate on the underlying bill, setting up possibly a vote on final passage next Thursday. A lot of procedural language in there. I apologize. So the Senate is moving very quickly to wrap this up. As we understand it, the amendment that was dropped today is over 300 pages long by itself, and so there's a lot of analysis to be done. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues, Jenny Rajewski, Josh Stelick, and Ximing Chir, to talk more about the specifics in the immigration reform bill in the Senate as it stands now. And then later on in the call, we'll talk about what is happening in the other chamber, the House of Representatives, in terms of immigration reform. We're going to start now with Jenny Rajewski, who's going to talk about health and public benefits and tax issues.
Hello, everyone. This is Jenny. In the Senate, you know, there were several amendments that we were monitoring, both good and bad ones, and many of them were part of this amendment deal that Don has been talking about. So I'll run through a few of those and share what we know so far about what was in this amendment. And, you know, again, we just got the language, so we're still analyzing. And if you're in the Healthy New Americans campaign and on that listserv, we'll be sharing analysis of the provisions that were in this amendment later today. So, you know, we had been We had been monitoring several bad amendments that were filed by Senators Hatch and Rubio on back taxes, on the ability to get credit for Social Security credit for earnings that were made while someone was unauthorized before they had provisional status, and as well as an amendment that would have put even longer waiting periods on access to the Affordable Care Act subsidies even after someone in provisional status gets their green card. So creating, instead of a 10-year wait for most of those folks before they can have access to some of the help from the Affordable Care Act, it would have been 15 years. We were also monitoring some good amendments, including an amendment that would have clarified that children and pregnant women who are either in registered provisional immigrant status or blue card status or have a V visa would have been able to get Medicaid and CHIP in about half the states, that half the states have taken up this option to expand those programs to lawfully present kids and pregnant women. So we were looking for some clarification on that, as well as an amendment. I'll tell you how these ended up, but just running through some of these amendments we were keeping an eye on. An amendment that would have counted time in provisional status towards the five-year bar for public benefit programs. And I guess I'm kind of assuming that people were on the last field call, but that's a bad assumption to make. So, I should say that the base bill excludes, it's pretty straightforward, it excludes everyone who is in registered provisional immigrant status, in the blue card status, and V visas, folks with V visas from all the public benefit programs, the big five public benefit programs, the Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, food stamps, cash assistance, and SSI. It also excludes folks in those provisional statuses from the Affordable Care Act and getting subsidies in the Affordable Care Act to buy private health insurance. So these were, these are already really bad restrictions, and we were really just trying to hold the line on some of this stuff. So sorry to get back to the good amendments. We were hoping that something might happen around this counting time in provisional status towards the five-year bar, so that when somebody gets their green card after they have gone through the provisional status, they would be able to immediately have access to the public benefit programs. And finally, we were had been monitoring an amendment around taxpayer fairness. This is something that Senator Hirono had introduced, a messaging amendment that basically says that, if people are paying taxes, if they are working, if they are complying with the rules of their immigration status under the Senate bill, then they should have access to those programs and benefits and tax credits that those taxes are paying for. To share what we know so far about what was in this Corker amendment, this Hoven-Corker amendment on this big amendment, it looks like on the back taxes issue and whether people, when they apply for their RPI status, would also have to prove that they have paid any taxes that they on work that they did while they were before they get their RPI status. It looks like that was not included as part of this amendment, so that is a good thing. In terms of Social Security earnings and getting credit for work that people did before they get their RPI status, there was some bad stuff that happened on that. So it looks like for work that was done between 2004 and 2014, either while someone was unauthorized or had an expired non-immigrant visa, that they wouldn't be able to get credit for those earnings when they get their provisional status. So that is a big change from current law, where people can unscramble their earnings in the past and get credit for the earnings that they have made even while they were working without authorization. And then finally on the Affordable Care Act and that Hatch amendment that we were looking for, that we were paying attention to in this amendment, what the amendment does is it dips into populations of people who have nothing to do with the immigration reform bill. Basically, it carves out people with B visas and F visas. So these are your tourist visas, your visitors for business, as well as your student visas. Those folks are now carved out of being eligible for the Affordable Care Act. They would have been in an eligible category, but many of them probably wouldn't have been able to actually get those benefits because they wouldn't have met other requirements like being residents of the state. But this is a bad precedent, a bad carve out, unfortunately. So that's something new that happened in this amendment. What's my time? Has anyone been keeping a track of time?
1 or 2 minutes.
Okay. So to wrap up on the Senate side, and I'm not going to have much to say on the House, so I'll use some of my time from the House. The issue of whether kids and pregnant women who are RPIs or blue card holders or V visa holders, whether they would be able to get Medicaid and CHIP in about half the states, including big states like California and New York, Illinois, if they would be able to have access to Medicaid and CHIP. This is still kind of an open question. This piece was not included in as part of this big amendment deal. The base bill was not terribly clear on whether these kids and pregnant women would be able to get coverage under this. This is called the IKEA option. It was something that was passed in the reauthorization of the CHIP program in 2009. And the CBO score, when the CBO score came out and looked at how much the bill would cost and how much revenue would bring in, CBO actually looked at the base bill and said that RPI kids and pregnant women would be able to get Medicaid and CHIP coverage, but they also raised a lot of concerns about, they said that there were several different interpretations that someone could make after reading the language, and they interpreted a certain way. And so it was kind of an odd thing for CBO to do, and the CBO score made it clear that it wasn't clear, basically, on this issue. And so we had been hoping that there would be an opportunity to get some clarity around whether kids and pregnant women could get coverage who gain legal status through this bill. And that is still, we feel like this is still needed, that we need to get clarification on this. And then I guess the last couple of things, we had also been keeping our eye on the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit, and whether there would be additional or whether there would be any restrictions added to this. We had certain amendments had been filed on this. It doesn't look like those amendments were part of the Hoven-Corker amendment, and so it looks good that there may not be any additional restrictions on the earned income tax credit or child tax credit. So people who gain legal status and RPI status or blue card status should be eligible for the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit as it looks right now. So I think I'll wrap it up there.
All right, I'll take over from Jenny. This is Josh Stalick, workers' rights attorney here at NILC. So we came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee's markup of the bill with most of our workers' rights priorities intact. And just to remind you, those priorities include the incorporation of the POWER Act to extend the availability of the U visa to whistleblowers and immigrant workers who experience significant workplace abuse, a fix to the Supreme Court's decision in Hoffman Plastics so that full remedies for illegal retaliation are available to undocumented workers, and also to ensure that worker protections and due process safeguards were included within the E-Verify mandate that is part of the Senate bill. In terms of the Corker-Hoven border security amendment that was filed within the last half hour, we had not heard of any proposed changes that would be included in that amendment to either the Hoffman Plastics fix or to the expansion of the U visa provisions. We had received conflicting information about whether changes to the E-Verify system in the Senate bill would be included in the amendment. Senator Portman had been pushing for what he said would be improvements to the E-Verify system, but we are not clear on what exactly those improvements would look like. And most recently, we have heard that E-Verify will not be included in this broad border security Corker-Hoven amendment. So we have just received the language of this amendment, and we're going to be drilling down in the hours to come to look closely to see if there are any changes to any of the workers' rights provisions that I've talked about and that we've been monitoring, and in particular, if any changes to the E-Verify system that's proposed in the bill have been included in the amendment. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleague, Xuming Qir, who will talk about some other aspects of this amendment.
Thank you. So as people have mentioned, we've just recently received the actual text of the border amendment. And so from what we've been hearing, some of the changes that are included that would significantly increase border militarization include hiring 20,000 new Border Patrol officers, which would basically double the current number of Border Patrol officers. Also, there includes a trigger that a 700-mile border fence must be complete. Right now, the border fence has already been completed over 350 miles, so this would basically add another 350 miles of fence construction. This would cost an estimated $48 billion over the next 10 years. And so in addition, there's another trigger involving a deployment of massive technology on the border, including drones. And some of the estimates around the cost of that are $3.2 trillion. So we definitely have significant concerns about the amount of money that's going to continue to be thrown at the border at a time when immigration is at a historic low. We're also really concerned about the impact that this will have on border communities, on people's civil rights, as well as on environmental issues at the border. In terms of some of the amendments that have been filed with the Senate that we're tracking, several of them were filed with the Senate Judiciary Committee and have since been refiled. This includes a Grassley amendment on gangs that would make it easier to deport people based on alleged gang membership, as well as exclude people from the temporary registered provisional immigrant status based on alleged gang membership. This amendment basically makes it very difficult for a person to challenge any evidence that they are part of a gang and would basically lead to increased targeting of youth and a further separation of families. One of the positive amendments that's been filed is Blumenthal-Murkowski 1327, which is the Little Dreamers Amendment. Basically, under the original Senate bill, Dreamers who meet all the requirements for the expedited Dream Path to legalization and citizenship but are too young to have graduated from high school would have to wait about 13 years to become citizens. So this amendment attempts to fix that by allowing people who would otherwise meet the requirements for the Dreamer Path but are too young to be able to have access to the same five-year path to citizenship as adult Dreamers would. There's another positive amendment that was filed that we are supporting, which is Cardin 1265. This is basically an amendment that reaffirms that only the federal government has the ability to regulate immigration law, and it also prohibits state and local laws from states and localities from creating penalties on the basis of immigration status. So this is important because despite the Supreme Court's decision in the Arizona SB 1070 case last year, some states and localities continue to pass laws targeting non-citizens. So I think I will leave it at that. I also wanted to mention, too, that there's a couple of amendments that have been filed that would basically make it easier to exclude people from the temporary RPI status based on convictions for domestic violence and child abuse. So we have a lot of concerns about these because they would exclude more people from legalization and also could be very problematic in terms of sweeping up people who are actual survivors of domestic violence. I'll leave it at that, and then later on I'll talk more about the developments on the House side.
Thank you, Xuming. This is Don Leister again. We're going to turn to a presentation about what's going on in the House of Representatives on immigration reform. As many of you on the call probably already know, there has been a bipartisan group that has been meeting for several years drafting comprehensive immigration reform bill for the House. A deal was reached among seven lawmakers, four Democrats and three Republicans, a couple weeks ago. And that bill is currently being drafted, we're told, and they could introduce it next week, although we've been hearing that for some time. So it's uncertain exactly when they will drop their bill and if actually they do it at all at this point, although their intention is to drop it. In the meantime, unfortunately, the House Republican leadership has decided to move forward individual bills to address immigration reform. This week, the House Judiciary Committee passed two very anti-immigrant, anti-worker bills. First, the SAVE Act, which is being coined as the son of Sensenbrenner because it's very similar to Congressman Sensenbrenner's bill that was passed by the House of Representatives some years ago. And among the bill's greatest shortcomings is that it would make it a crime, potentially a felony, to be undocumented in this country, thereby criminalizing all 11 million. And I'm sure Shumin can talk a little bit more about that later on. And then the second bill that was passed by the committee this week is the Agriculture Guest Worker Act, which would create a massive new agriculture guest worker program without an opportunity for undocumented farm workers to earn immigration status or citizenship. And next week, we are expecting the House Judiciary Committee to consider Congressman Lamar Smith's Legal Workforce Act, which would require a mandatory E-Verify system to be implemented. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Jenny Rajewski to talk a little bit about any discussions around access to health and benefits in the House.
And thank you. So on the House side, where we left things last with our health conversations had to do with the bipartisan bill that the gang of seven now were discussing. So the last thing that happened was that Congressman Labrador, there were discussions on the health pieces at the very end of the bipartisan discussions, and health and benefits issues were the last things that they negotiated, and there was a lot of back and forth between the Republicans and the Democrats at the end of that deal-making process, or at the end of that negotiation, and in the end, Congressman Labrador did walk away from the bipartisan talks because of the health issues, and they couldn't come to an agreement. The rest of the folks decided that, you know, they would agree to disagree on the health issues. And as far as we know, if a bipartisan bill were to be introduced, it would, on the health and benefits and economic support sides, it would likely look very much like what the Senate bill does. So excluding folks who gain provisional status from federal public benefit programs as well as from the Affordable Care Act. But we, of course, don't know for sure because that bill has not been introduced yet. And then for the bills that are moving on the House side and those piecemeal bills, those don't include anything on health and benefits. The health and benefits and economic support stuff live in the legalization section, and there's not a piecemeal legalization bill yet, so those issues haven't come up in committee. And I think that's it.
So this is Josh again. As Don mentioned, we are braced for a markup next week of the Legal Workforce Act in the House Judiciary Committee. And as Don mentioned, the Legal Workforce Act mandates the use of E-Verify ultimately by every employer in the United States. However, the Legal Workforce Act is very different, or the E-Verify system that the Legal Workforce Act calls for is very different from the E-Verify system that is laid out in the Senate bill. I mean, first and foremost, there's no legalization program or road to citizenship contained in the Legal Workforce Act. It is strictly a standalone E-Verify mandate that, in fact, has been introduced in past House sessions, including in 2011. The Legal Workforce Act also contains a much faster E-Verify implementation timeline, so it would require all employers in the U.S. to be using E-Verify within 2 years, and that's compared to 5 years, the five-year phase-in that's contained in the Senate bill. And then the Legal Workforce Act also contains no formal due process for workers to challenge an erroneous determination by the E-Verify system that they are unauthorized to work. And again, that contrasts starkly with the Senate bill, which contains a formal administrative as well as judicial review process for workers who are erroneously flagged by the E-Verify system. And finally, there are no affirmative penalties under the Legal Workforce Act for employers who misuse the E-Verify system in violation of the program rules or to discriminate or retaliate against workers. So it is just not a good bill and poses a myriad of potential harms to American and immigrant workers alike. We're very hopeful that the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee will oppose the Legal Workforce Act next week, but even if all of the Democratic members on the committee oppose, it would still get voted out of committee. So we are busy educating members about the harms of the Legal Workforce Act, and there is the potential for members to offer positive amendments that would improve the bill, but currently it's very unclear whether any of those sorts of amendments could garner a majority support in the House Judiciary Committee. That appears unlikely, but remains to be seen. So if you want to learn a lot more about the Legal Workforce Act, we have materials on our NILC website that analyze in detail the contents of the bill and also that describe NILC's concerns about the harms that it poses. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Xu Ming to talk a little bit about the SAFE Act and other enforcement issues pending in the House of Representatives.
Thank you. So as mentioned, on June 18th, the House Judiciary Committee approved the SAFE Act, which stands for the Strengthen and Fortify Enforcement Act, by a vote of 20-15. This act is extremely heavy-handed and very problematic, so I'm just going to highlight some of the key provisions that are going to be very devastating for our communities. First of all, it grants states and localities the full authority to create, implement, and enforce their own criminal and civil penalties for federal immigration violations. So basically, this would allow each and every state to create their own laws, particularly punitive laws, that punish immigration violations. And even though this would go directly against the opinion that the Supreme Court made last year in the Arizona versus United States case. Also, the act gives state and local law enforcement the unrestricted ability to enforce immigration laws. So what that means is that state and local law enforcement officers could investigate and also identify and arrest people who they suspect of being here in the country in violation of immigration laws. This would lead to a lot of racial profiling, as many law enforcement officers are not trained in the complexities of immigration law and would basically use their own ideas or their own opinions about what a person looks like to basically assume that that person is here in the country unlawfully and to then take action against them. Also, I think some of you have heard that Representative King had introduced an amendment to restrict the administration's ability to implement programs such as DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, and other policies that would basically allow the federal government to exercise discretion in terms of deciding who they would detain and deport. And so parts of the SAFE Act also restrict the federal government's ability to do that, to use their prosecutorial discretion ability. Additionally, the SAFE Act also allows states and local jurisdictions to detain people for 14 days after they complete their jail or prison sentences in order to transfer them to ICE custody. It also makes changes that would expand the 287G program. This program has been widely criticized due to the amount of abuses that have happened under it, including in Maricopa County, Arizona, where law enforcement basically used racial profiling to target people who appear to be immigrants. In terms of changing information and databases, the SAFE Act also
would require that the National Crime and Information Center database be filled with millions of non-criminal records so that people who have, for instance, received an order of removal or had their visas revoked would have that information then input into the NCIC database, which is typically used by law enforcement officers to decide if somebody has violated a criminal law. And finally, as Don had mentioned, the act is very extreme in terms of criminalizing the fact that somebody entered the country unlawfully. Right now, that only applies if somebody is apprehended while they're trying to enter the U.S., but what this act would do instead is to make illegal entry into the U.S. a continuing offense until a person is discovered by federal officials. And so this would, and would also criminalize people who overstay their visa even by a single day. So due to all these extreme consequences of the act, we sent out a sign-on letter earlier this week for people to oppose this act as well as the LWA. And so over 130 organizations signed on to that letter. You can also find that on our website. So with that, I think we are now going to move into the question and answer session.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone phone. We'll pause for a moment to allow questions to queue. We'll take our first question from Teresa Arellano with Santana Immigration.
Yes. I will make it very, very brief. You mentioned that the earned income credit and the child tax credit are safe right now. It seems like we're going to be able to claim that. My question is, do you know if a person who receives that status can claim the earned income credit in years past? Currently, we can go 3 years back and request EIC when a person gets their Social Security number. And I'm wondering, if the EIC is okay, is it going to be only from that point forward, or can that person go back the 3 years and amend their returns to claim that credit? And how do I go off of here? Do I press star? Hello?
I'll go ahead and answer the question. So far, there has been nothing was added in the amendment around earned income tax credit or child tax credit. So that means that existing rules would continue to apply. So yes, they would be able to claim the earned income tax credit for the 3 prior years as well. And just wanted to also say that we're not exactly sure if there will be more amendments coming up next week. This isn't a done deal yet, but the way things stand now, and it's a good thing that this wasn't part of the Corker Amendment or the Corker-Hoven Amendment, but it's not over until it's all over, so we shall see.
And as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. We'll pause for another moment to allow questions to queue.
And in addition to questions, if people have any comments or any feedback or any reactions to what's happening in both the Senate and the House, feel free to share those also.
We'll take a question from Anne Matthews with National Women's Law Center. Your line is open.
Hi, I wanted to hear a little more about this. This is a Social Security amendment. I know that Hatch 24 was that amendment. I was wondering, you said that amendment did go through. I just wanted to confirm on that and if there had been any changes to it.
All right, so what I can share so far is that there were changes to the original Hatch amendment on Social Security. So the way it looks right now is that RPIs would not get any credit for unauthorized work performed between January 2004 and January 2014. Mm-hmm. Also, that people who overstayed their visa can't get credit for work while they were unauthorized performed between those same dates, January 2004 and January 2014. So those RPIs who were working before 2004 and can unscramble those earnings can get credit for those earnings.
Okay.
But not for the 10
2004 and 2014.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And again, to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. We'll pause for another moment. We'll go now to Maria Rodriguez from Florida Immigrant Coalition.
Hi. Thanks for having the call. Is there a document that you have that shows where the bill stands at this moment right now? Because I know there's been different amendments. It's kind of hard to keep track of everything that's being proposed versus things that are actually being approved. That's one question. And the second question is, I'm beginning to see that people are talking about the benefits and the barriers and the borders. It's kind of funny. It's a counterpart to the BBB. But on the barriers to legalization, employment requirement and back taxes are still obviously in the bill. What else are other barriers that are not related to the fees and to the English?
I'll address the publications question and then turn it over to my colleague Josh to address the other ones. We do have a document that we just added to our website that provides an analysis of the Senate bill after it was passed out of the committee, so not only a summary of it as it was introduced, but then the changes that were made to it during the committee action. We anticipate doing the same once the floor process is complete, but at this point, as amendments continue to be filed, including the very large one today, we haven't yet done a full analysis that's available online.
In terms of barriers or eligibility requirements to be eligible for RPI status, you mentioned the employment requirement, and there is an employment requirement in the base bill that a person in RPI status must be regularly employed for the duration of RPI status at the point where they become eligible. They must prove regular employment for the first 6 years of RPI status at the point at which they would then renew their RPI status, and then they have to remain regularly employed for the next 4 years, at which point they would become eligible then to adjust to legal permanent resident status. And the bill defines regular employment as basically someone who's not been unemployed for more than a 60-day period during that time. And then the bill lays out certain exceptions to that requirement, including disability, including being the primary caretaker of a dependent, and including a catch-all exception for folks who are unemployed through no fault of their own, So that is one eligibility requirement for folks in the RPI process, and we do have concerns about any of those exceptions to the requirement being removed or made more narrow. We haven't received any information that was likely to happen in this Corker-Hoven amendment, but that's something we'll have to look closely at now that we have the language in hand. Another thing we'll be looking closely at is whether there's any changes to the fines and fees that someone has to pay both at the point of applying for RPI status and then at renewal and at adjustment. So again, that's another issue that we'll have to look at more closely in the recently released amendment.
And you had asked about taxes. Currently, the bill doesn't include restrictions on the EITC, nor are there back tax requirements. But again, we have another week to go in this Senate debate, and so there is always the possibility that those issues could come up.
We'll go now to the site of Scarlett DeLeon with KIWA. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm with Kiwa. I think they got that wrong. But So going off that note, off the RPI status, we just wanted to say that we strongly support the Cardin Amendment 1294, which would allow for community service to be counted as employment. And we think that's really important because a lot of our folks, you know, they're stay-at-home moms, or if they get paid in cash, like jornaleros and stuff, and folks like that. So since we were just talking about the RPI status, we just wanted to go off that and just say that we are hoping that 1294 will really get pushed.
Thank you for your comment. And as you may know, I believe it's Endelon is circulating a sign-on letter in support of the Cardin Amendments that you just referenced.
Yeah.
So we encourage organizations that are interested in signing on to do so, and we can perhaps after this call forward it around to folks on the call.
That would be great. Thank you so much.
We'll go now to Barbara Weiner with Empire Justice Center. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. I have a question about, I think Jenny was talking about people who would be excluded from access to the healthcare exchange, people with F visas, and I didn't actually catch all the different kinds of visas, but does this essentially wipe away the eligibility of non-immigrants who have not violated their status?
It was real specific on just F visas and B visas.
Okay.
And we can, Barbara, I don't know if you're on the Helping New Americans listserv, but I shared the language on that piece of the amendment. I can forward it along to you so you can see what the actual language says. But it alters, it requires HHS and Treasury, it directs HHS and Treasury to change their regulations to carve out those folks from the definition of lawfully present. So it was an unfortunate way of getting to this issue, but it is just B's and F's.
Okay, and I had one other question, which actually is just seeking a clarification on the summary that Nilk's done of the bill, and I just want to make sure I understand that people who are not eligible for RPI is anyone who has been a lawful permanent resident, asylee, or refugee in the past, or is this currently present in the U.S. in a lawful non-immigrant status? I'm assuming that somebody who was in a lawful non-immigrant status but has long ago fallen out of that status would be eligible to apply for RPI?
Right, that's correct. The restriction is based on somebody not having either permanent or temporary immigration status on the date that the bill was introduced. So you're correct. If somebody came in initially on a valid visitor's visa, but then since then fell out of status and were out of status on the date of the bill's introduction, they would qualify to apply for RPI status, assuming that they meet all the other requirements also.
Okay, so it's a little bit like the DACA requirement of being out of status on the date the bill, the effective date, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Okay, thanks.
We'll go now to the site of Francisco Duenas with Lambda Legal. Your line is open.
Hi, I just had a question about the criminal exclusions that are currently in the bill that would limit access to the pathway to citizenship, and if there were any exceptions to them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, in general, the criminal exclusions are pretty broad. So anybody who has an aggravated felony conviction, a felony conviction, or three misdemeanor convictions under the language of the bill as it was introduced would not be eligible for RPI status. Also, anybody who's inadmissible under current immigration law would not be eligible, so that's a pretty broad definition of who is inadmissible currently. And also just to mention, even around the misdemeanors and the felony issues, that can also sweep up people with convictions such as for possession of a controlled substance, because in many places that's treated as a felony. We are very concerned that there's a wide group of people who would not be eligible for RPI status. There's some limited waivers, but they apply to very few of the misdemeanors. And as I mentioned, some of the amendments that have been introduced are attempts to widen the criminal exclusions even more.
Thank you for your question, Francisco, and we have time for one more question. And if we aren't able to get to any questions that you may have, please feel free to email us at reply@nilc.org.
We'll take our final question from Karelia Harding with Oregon Child Development Coalition. Your line is open.
Yes, I was just going to say thank you so much for having this this conference, but I did want to just ask for any suggestions that you may have and what we can do locally, especially to support families that they are into the legal situation, you know, how to navigate all the information. And then if you know, I know you have some information already in Spanish, but is there any place that you feel that we can probably check in to get more information in Spanish for the families, especially when sometimes, you know, people start taking advantage of families and, you know, start creating information that is not the correct one.
Shumaine?
I'm sorry?
Oh, sure. I think after next week, after the bill passes out of the Senate, hopefully, we can post a short frequently asked questions, and we can translate that into Spanish also. I think we'll have to discuss further what other materials we can translate, but we'll definitely try to make that a priority because we know it's important for people to get the information in the language that they know best.
Great. So at this point, we're going to wrap up. Thank you again for joining us for this important call. It's critical for those of us at NILC who are working on these issues day in and day out to hear from all of you out in the field, to hear your feedback and to answer your questions. And we hope to continue to keep everyone engaged. We are planning to have another field call, we believe, in 2 weeks, and we look forward to connecting with you then. In the meantime, we encourage you all to contact your members of Congress to urge them to support immigration reform and to visit the NILC website for more information or follow us on Twitter and Facebook.